It is never too late to expand the mind of a person on the autism spectrum. Our first guest today spoke those words. Dr. Temple Grandin is sometimes referred to as the best-known person with autism in the world. That's due to her renown in not one, but two fields. First, her groundbreaking work in animal welfare. She's best known for designing humane cattle handling facilities that are used for half the cattle in the United States. And second, her ongoing writing and advocacy for people like herself on the autism spectrum. Dr. Grandin's been in Lansing the last few days, speaking at gatherings about both autism and animal welfare. I sat down with her yesterday and first asked about a comment on her website. She writes about 1950s methods for teaching social skills that worked for me. I asked her what she meant.
Well, as a young autistic kid, in the 50s methods, instead of yelling and screaming at kids when they do something wrong, like bad table manners, they simply give the instruction. If I put my finger in the mashed potatoes, mother would say, use the fork. You give the instruction. You explain them how they should behave.
Were you suggesting that some approaches from decades ago have been abandoned and ought to be revived?
Well, in the 50s, kids were taught table manners in a much more structured way. I went to college with a lot of kids that I know are on the autism spectrum. When I was 4 years old, I had no speech. I was really severe. And then there's other kids that are just socially awkward. And they own businesses today, ones of my generation, because the social skills were taught in a much more structured manner.
Mm-hmm. You also write that excessive praise is bad for a young person on the autism spectrum. Why is that?
Well, it's bad for all kids. I was praised when I did a really exceptional art project, but I was not praised for being on time for school pickup. That was something that was simply expected.
Do adults commonly respond that way to an autistic child?
Well, the thing with autism is it goes all the way from Silicon Valley to Einstein, who had no language till age 3, Thomas Edison probably was on the autism spectrum. And so you're going from somebody that's just socially awkward, super smart, that ought to be working for Google, to somebody who can't dress themselves. It's all called the same thing. I've been to NASA. Oh, you've got people on the spectrum there, and they've got autistic grandkids. See, a little bit of the trait gives you somebody who's super smart but socially awkward. Too much of the trait, you get much more handicaps.
But do you meet parents, or do you hear about parents who praise excessively a child on the spectrum?
Oh, yeah, and they also overprotect. I'm seeing smart 13-year-old kids that are fully verbal, that nobody's taught them how to shop. Just basic skills, things that I learned when I was 7.
We are talking with Dr. Temple Grandin while she's in East Lansing, the reformer, inventor, author. We're talking about autism, and we will be talking about animal welfare issues here in just a minute. You've also described the advantages that sensory therapies can have for young people on the spectrum. I guess the most common one is deep pressure therapy, or it's one of the most common.
It works for some, and it doesn't for others. See, the problem is autism is a spectrum. And I discussed this in my book, The Autistic Brain. Also in my book, Thinking in Pictures, I discuss experiences with pressure. Pressure works for some kids. It doesn't work for everybody, but there are some kids that respond well to that. Also in my books, I talk about visual thinking. I'm a visual thinker. That helped me in my design work because I could visually think about how to design something. Other kinds of kids are mathematical minds. Other kids are word thinkers. Take the thing that the kid's good at and build on it.
But for our listeners who don't know what deep pressure therapy is, can you describe it?
Well, basically, it'd be something as simple as getting two cushions and just putting pressure on or a weighted vest. You know how the weighted X-ray apron feels?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Some people find that kind of relaxing. Some kids really respond well to that. It works for some. It doesn't work for others.
Last year, a study out of the Drexel Autism Institute in Philadelphia found that 40% of people on the autism spectrum can't find work, despite perhaps very desirable skills that they might possess, analytical powers or any number of things. I'm curious what you make of that situation, the challenge of finding a job for a lot of people on the spectrum, and what you think might be done
about
that. All
right, let's talk about the 60% of the people that are fully, completely verbal, normal intelligence or greater. The big problem is not learning how to work. When I was 13, my mother got me a sewing job. When I was 15, I was cleaning 8 horse stalls every day. Then I went out to my aunt's ranch. And then I got career-relevant internships when I was in college, working in a research lab. One of the ways to improve the working is a kid needs to hold down 2 jobs, something like Walmart or McDonald's, before they graduate high school. So they learn working skills, getting to work on time. You've got to do it. And then they're going to find employment. Also, I worked with a lot of quirky, different kinds of guys in welding and in drafting when I worked with the big meatpacking plants. Okay, Cargill's one company where I have designed equipment for the front end of their beef plants all over North America. And I worked with guys in the shop that I know are on the spectrum. And you know what saved those guys? They took welding in high school. One of the worst things the schools have done is taken out all the hands-on classes. Cooking, sewing, woodworking, art, theater. All these kind of things that can help the kids that are quirky and different to go into a career.
I want to ask you a question just from my own curiosity. I mean, you're old enough that you remember life before computers or
yes.
personal computers. I'm curious, did you adapt to computers and the digital life easily, or was that harder?
Well, when it comes to finding things online, I can outsurf the young ones. Very, very definitely. You know, my paper library skills went right over to Google just fine. But I'm concerned about the kids getting addicted to video games. And they're not having good outcomes. I'm hearing mom saying he's 21, he's playing video games 8 hours a day. That needs to be limited. The other thing I have learned about careers, students get interested in careers they get exposed to. I got interested in going into beef cattle because I was exposed to them when I was 15, when I went out to my aunt's ranch. And I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch originally. My mother gave me a choice. I could go for a week or I could go all summer. Not going was not going to be one of the choices. We got to get these kids out of the house doing things.
Generally, would you say that people with autism are good with technology, or is it generally more of a challenge?
Well, it varies a whole lot. Mm. You know, I'm interested in getting these kids working, and they've got to learn social skills like being in a foreign country. It's got to be taught in a much more structured sort of way. And again, autism goes from people who work for Silicon Valley to somebody who can't dress themselves. So I don't want to be overgeneralizing about this.
You spent yesterday discussing animal welfare issues with a variety of people, including quite a few veterinarians here at Michigan State. What kind of animal welfare issues are veterinarians facing here in 2016?
Well, I talked a lot about the importance of stockmanship in handling livestock. It was a livestock talk. People always want the magical thing more than they want the management. And I've designed a lot of cattle handling facilities. And I found over a 40-year career that selling the new facilities was easy. The more difficult thing was getting people to actually operate it correctly, the management side of it. You know, management is a whole lot of little details that add up to a big thing. And I talked about some scientific studies that show that good stockmanship, where cattle are low fear, are more productive cattle. I showed some tips on cattle handling, some handler movement patterns. If you're interested in this stuff, I've got a book called Humane Livestock Handling, lots of diagrams of how to move cattle, lots of stuff on my website, grandin.com, on handling cattle. That was some of the main stuff I talked about yesterday.
What welfare improvements have been made in recent years for animals that are raised for food?
One of the biggest is improvement at the slaughter plants. That is one part of the industry that has really improved. I've done a lot of work, especially with cattle and pig slaughter plants. You know, the bad old days back in the 80s, they were really, really bad. And then I worked with McDonald's and Wendy's around 1999, 2000, and I came up with a very simple way to audit animal welfare at slaughter plants. They had to make certain numbers, like no more than 3 cattle out of 100 mooing in the stunning area. They had to make their numbers, very simple, straightforward way of evaluating them. Handling has improved. That is one of the bright spots in animal welfare.
Give us another example.
Feed yard handling's gotten better. My student Ruth Woliwode went out to a whole bunch of feed yards in Kansas and Colorado, and evaluated cattle handling. That had improved. There's still some other welfare issues, but handling is one area where it's improved. It's not perfect, but compared to 20 years ago, it's light years better.
What is really important that you would say remains to be done? What's ahead of us here in terms of improving?
Well, like we were just out at the feed yard. We've got to make sure that we don't let cattle get lame. Let's look at some of the things we need to assess welfare on a feed yard or dairy, for example. A dairy, body condition score. Don't let them get too skinny. All of the livestock, lameness. Many, many different things can make cattle lame and have sore feet and have difficulty walking. I can measure that. I want to keep that lameness at a very, very low level. If your animals are living inside, we've got to keep them clean. So that's bedding and management. That's another thing I'm going to look at. Swollen legs, I got to make sure that they're not getting swollen legs. Those are things that I can manage. Indoor animals keep ammonia levels in the building really low. Really simple things. In fact, I have a book, Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach, where we can look at simple things like lameness, and I want to keep it at a low level. Because if I measure that lameness, then I can tell, am I getting better or am I getting worse? You manage the things that you measure.
And you can point to, I mean, for animals that are raised for food or for dairy cattle, let's say.
All right.
If they're not experiencing lameness, is the resulting food higher quality? Can you draw a correlation to that?
Well, I can usually draw a correlation.
Or is it more of a humane?
Well, it's humane, but it's also productivity. Lame animals are not going to be as productive.
What don't consumers know that you think maybe they ought to know about how animals are raised for food?
Well, Fair Oaks Farm outside of Chicago is doing an absolutely fabulous job. Have a great big, gigantic, huge dairy. It's open to the public so people can see what a big, huge commercial dairy looks like. They also have a pig farm that's open to the public. I think ag needs to be opening up the door and showing what they're doing. And Fair Oaks Farm is doing a wonderful job at this.
Hmm. What do you think are the biggest consumer misconceptions?
Well, one of them is big is bad. That's a common misconception. What I have found is badly managed is bad. And you can have badly managed in all different sizes of operations.
One component of your talks yesterday were involved the biological limits of animal production from an animal welfare perspective. Can you explain what that was about?
Well, you can push an animal genetically. I'm very concerned about leg conformation issues right now in cattle. That's genetic. Also, I'm concerned about animals like the bulldog. You've bred this animal, extreme animal. It has difficulty breathing, difficulty walking, has to have its puppies by cesarean. I think that's a big welfare issue. That's an example of genetically just pushing an animal too far. You could push it too far with a feed additive or just too high concentrate feed. You've got to be careful of not pushing the biology. Some of my biggest concerns right now today are genetic.
Do you have another book planned?
Well, I'm working on a book right now for livestock handling for small producers.
And when do you expect that to come out?
That'll come out in the spring.
And talk to us about your position at Colorado State. Is it a good place to be on the faculty?
No, Colorado's a beautiful, beautiful place. I've got graduate students, and one of the problems they're having is they don't want to leave Colorado because it is beautiful. And I've been doing a lot of different kinds of things. One study that one of my students worked on was to look at temperament differences in mama cows and how they protect their calves. And some moms are great mothers and call the calf and protect it. And others, there's a few that walk away from it. That's not something you'd want to have.
We've been talking with Dr. Temple Grandin while she's in East Lansing. We've been talking with her about autism and animal welfare issues. Enjoy your visit to East Lansing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.